Hello and welcome to another episode of the AggieCon MT podcast series, part of the AggieConMT.com website and the production of the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University. I am Anton Beckerman, your host for today, and we've got a really interesting topic and a really interesting guest, Dr. Amanda Countryman from Colorado State University. She's a trade economist. And we also have Dr. Eric Velasco, a contributor to the AggieCon MT project and podcast and blog. You guys know him. You've probably seen him in a bunch of presentations around the state. So welcome, Amanda. Welcome, Eric.
It's thanks good to here. Be back on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great to have you here at MSU. So we're talking about cool country of origin labeling, and this is a very livestock-oriented podcast. So this is a really important and topic over the past, I guess, decade now. And so it'll be good to think about what's been going on and what happened and where we are now and where we're going and, you know, trade-offs, because we're economists. We love talking about trade-offs. So let's start with this. Amanda, what is cool? Where did it come from? Why did it happen? Who wanted it?
So country of origin labeling actually has a rather interesting start. So most U.S. imports are actually required to be labeled by country of origin according to 1930s tariff law. So I think one of the misnomers about country of origin labeling is that a lot of people thought that this is a new thing and that, you know, it's just suddenly this new policy that was implemented in the United States. But most products since the 1930s have been required to label the country in which they originate. But what's different is that with the 2008 U.S. Farm Bill, many agricultural commodities, including meat, fish, shellfish, peanuts, and some other perishables, for the first time were required to be labeled in the United States in terms of their country of origin. So what happened was this was the first time that meat was required to be labeled, and that had an interesting domestic perspective. So producers had different perspectives about whether or not that was a good thing, whether or not that was a bad thing. But from the start, our trade partners in Canada and Mexico were very adverse to this labeling that they thought was going to have a negative impact on their potential exports of livestock into the U.S. supply chain. So perhaps, Eric, you can talk a little bit about the producer perspective in the U.S. of how cool got its start and how that went.
Before we get there, why would country of origin labeling be important? Is it a safety thing? Is it a market thing? Do producers want it, Eric? Do consumers want it? Like, why?
I think you'll get a different answer to that question depending on who you talk to. So if you were to talk to consumers, consumers would say, I have a right to know where my meat comes from, where that livestock originated from, and I want to know. I want to know because perhaps I have a perceived or a perception of the safety of that particular product. And I hopefully Eric is going to talk more in a second about the producer perspective on that. But I want to really highlight the importance of the food safety regulations that we have in the United States. We have one of the safest, most abundant food supplies in the entire world. And even though we import a lot of agricultural products from other countries, there may be some sort of perceived issue with safety, but we have a lot of regulations put in place to make sure that our domestic food supply, even if it originated outside of this country, has passed inspections and regulations to make sure that it's safe for our consumption.
Sure. Yeah. And I think along those lines, you do see a lot of beef products that are branded. If they are raised, grown, and also slaughtered in the same place, you'll see them branded. I was up in Canada and you see the Alberta beef brand up there. But what happens with live animals, I think, is what really kind of causes an issue with cool, where you have animals coming in from Canada where they are born in Canada, fed in the U.S. and slaughtered in the U.S. What do you label them? Are they Canadian? Are they U.S. animals? And so, you know, yeah, the consumer, you know, wanting to know where their beef is coming from is an important thing. Are consumers willing to pay for that information? So no information is free. On the other hand, I think a lot of ranchers in Montana feel like if people just knew where their beef was coming from, they would pay a premium. So a lot of people in the state who I talk to, like, well, if, you know, M-Cool would just lead to higher prices for Montana beef products, because if people, you know, knew that their beef was coming from the U.S. and they could put it against, you know, a Canadian beef product, they might give it some premium. You know, most of the research I've seen, and you've done some great research in this area too, of looking at, you know, what kind of premiums are out there for those. I don't know if the consumers have quite put those in there. There was a study by Michael Taylor and Glenn Tonser a few years back in the JER where they looked at those premiums and they found that they were insignificant. And so, you know, consumers having a right to know, I think, you know, if you ask a consumer, well, do you want to know where your beef comes from? They'd say, yeah, sure. How much would you be willing to pay for that information? And would it compensate the producers for that cost, I think, is an interesting question here with this Cool.
So, first of all, what is M-Cool?
Yeah, sorry, I just ran into that. So, mandatory country of origin labeling.
Yep. And how, okay, so Cool is just, I can voluntarily put a label on it that it's produced in Canada or Mexico or in the United States. Mandatory Cool is this policy where you have to label it, right?
Right.
Okay. I think you read my mind, Anton, because what I was just thinking about, you know, Eric's talking about how there are some producers throughout the country and some in Montana for sure who really feel strongly that there can be a premium to be gained for domestically produced beef. And what's important to remember is that producers have the ability to label and capture that rent or premium if they believe it's in the market without requiring everyone to do it. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that perspective is that when you require everyone else to do it, you actually lose out on the potential to have a differentiated product. Mm-hmm. If you're of the idea that you have additional rent to be gained relative to other producers that may not label if it's not required, if everyone has to label, then your, we'll say, Montana born and raised beef products aren't different from your competitors because everybody's has to label it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is good because at first, when you guys were talking, I thought Cool was like the best thing in the world and why aren't we doing more of it, right? Like consumers are loving it because of the safety aspects. Producers are loving it because of the branding capabilities and differentiation capabilities. But now we're getting into some of the negative. So, Amanda, can you talk a little bit about who didn't like it and why was, I'm guessing, M-Cool repealed eventually? How did we come to that decision?
So I think originally Cool had pretty good support overall in the U.S. industry, in the U.S. livestock and beef supply chain. But what's interesting is that, as Eric mentioned just a bit ago, I think there was a perception that there would be this premium to be gained across the board for U.S. beef. But then once M-Cool was implemented, we really didn't see an uptick in demand for domestic beef. So while there was this widespread belief that we could have this increase in demand for U.S. beef, it just didn't really happen. The data don't support an increase in U.S. beef consumption once Cool was implemented. And so while I think there was relatively strong support across the board when this legislation first went into place, after the fact, I think that there was a lot more thought or a lot more information provided about what those costs of implementing the policy actually are, and then trying to compare what those supply chain costs to separate livestock that are brought in from another country. So if you have commingled beef, it can't be labeled U.S. beef. So if you have livestock that comes in from Canada, you can't have it in pens. You can't have it together with domestic livestock. So there are costs associated with doing it. I think that early on started to get some producers starting to think a little bit more about what the implications of the mandatory labeling are.
Right. And that's a really good point. And correct me if I'm wrong. So the WTO, this issue went through the WTO and the Canadian producers felt like their animals were being discriminated against because of this, you know, non-commingling. And the stories I read were that a lot of them were being turned away from feedlots, certainly given a discount, and not necessarily based on quality, but just because they all had to sort of stay contained in the same area. And so Cool certainly came with, you know, its own sort of cost. And one of the interesting things I guess we were talking about earlier was, you have a paper where you're looking at cool legislation and relating it to welfare implications. You talk a minute about how do you link those two together? How do we come up with, I mean, it's one thing to come up with a price premium. We can understand that. But how do we associate that with welfare?
That's a great question. So I'll take a little bit of a step back and say that when we want to think about the economic implications of imposing this kind of policy, you can look at information in a lot of different ways. So as you just mentioned, you could look at price information and try to figure out, were there discounts offered to imported livestock relative to U.S. domestic prices? That's one thing you could look at. But some of the work that I have done in looking at, for example, the cost of repealing, or not the cost, but the cost savings of repealing the legislation, the USDA has estimates of costs along the livestock and beef supply chain of the impacts of having to have these separate facilities or not allowing for commingling. That has cost implications. So we can look throughout the beef supply chain, if we were to remove these costs associated with cool, what are the welfare impacts of that? So you could see that as, in a way, you could think of it as a technical efficiency gain, because we're no longer incurring these additional costs if we are importing livestock, which we do in our domestic supply chain. So I think you can link, you know, these cost implications of the cool repeal relative to not repealing the legislation, for example.
Well, I'm looking along the supply chain. Obviously, we have, you know, cow-calf, we have feedlots, we have processors. Where do most of the costs, where are they born along that supply chain? Do they tend to go kind of to the intermediate, processing part, or who tends to take on those costs?
So the costs of cool are definitely distributed along the supply chain. And what the USDA has estimated is that the cost at the processing and retail level, at both of those levels, is about twice as high as the cost borne at the farm gate, so where those livestock originate, so for the cow-calf guys, for example. Okay. Those operating costs are estimated to be a little over 1% for the farm level, so for the cow-calf operation level, and then about 2 to just over 2% for processing, and then for the retail sector. So we can see that these costs are distributed along the supply chain, and then the implications of those costs depend on what you assume about how sensitive, number one, how sensitive consumers are to changes in prices, as well as how you're able to, or whether or not you are able to, pass those costs along to consumers.
Right. Yeah. And to get back to you, what the paper is. So the paper, again, has welfare effects, and a lot of people listening to this are non-economists. So you take costs and you've taken them across the supply chain. How do you translate that into welfare?
The easiest way to think about this might be if I'm a consumer who's going to the grocery store. So if there is a reduction in production costs, there is going to be some sort of transfer of those changes in prices to consumers. And so what we can think about is, if I'm a consumer going to the grocery store and we have a relatively small decrease in the cost of beef production in the U.S. because of this legislation that's repealed, how does that impact my general well-being? So for example, how am I impacted in terms of my consumption and how well off I am in terms of my well-being, and how do those changes in prices impact my well-being at the end of the day? Mm-hmm. So for example, if beef becomes relatively cheaper, then if I like beef, and I do, I will be better off. So my well-being will be better off. So that's kind of how we like to think of welfare.
Kind of in a willingness to pay context, or your ability to pay for certain goods and services. Yeah.
Right. What we haven't talked about yet is why U.S. Congress repealed COOL in the first place. So the reason why we repealed the legislation wasn't because of a massive opposition that just suddenly arose because producers didn't want it anymore. It was really a combination of producers were starting to question the costs associated with COOL. And as you mentioned earlier, Eric, all along, Canada and Mexico were not in favor and felt that their livestock were being negatively impacted by this legislation in an unnecessary or non-compliant way with the rules that the U.S. has agreed to under the World Trade Organization, or the WTO. So we went through several years of litigation under the dispute settlement panel in the WTO. And there were a few different rulings. And then there was a final ruling made in 2015, and the U.S. was given a choice. The WTO said that our mandatory country of origin labeling did in fact discriminate against Canadian and Mexican livestock. And it was pointed to the fact that there was a negative price implication for imported livestock relative to domestic prices for domestic livestock. And so because the WTO ruled in favor of Canada and Mexico, the U.S. had the opportunity of one of two things. We could either repeal the legislation, or if we were to maintain the legislation, then Canada and Mexico were given the ability to retaliate against the United States. And what that means is Canada and Mexico could have put import tariffs on products that we send to their countries beyond just beef or livestock. They could have targeted, and they announced intentions to retaliate across a wide variety of product categories, focused largely on agriculture, but not agriculture alone. And Canada could have retaliated against the United States for a certain amount of compensation that the WTO felt would provide a financial compensation for the negative impacts for their livestock sector. And what's interesting about retaliation is that the retaliation that Canada and Mexico announced, again, was widespread across not just agriculture, but non-agriculture as well. So what really caused the United States to move forward to repeal the legislation was that the U.S. agricultural industry across different sectors really banded together and said, we don't want to continue maintaining this mandatory country of origin labeling, because if we do, we're going to face tariffs exporting products across agricultural sectors to Canada. So, for example, the dairy industry was very vocal in their concerns about potential retaliatory measures from Canada in particular, because had we not repealed COOL, we would have faced import tariffs in dairy and a variety of other products.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, because we, in our last podcast, which you haven't, if you haven't listened to it, it's a great discussion on the WTO and trade issues going on now. You talked about the issues between the U.S. and China, where we have sort of gone around the WTO framework. But with MCOOL, it sounds like a, you know, the framework that sort of went right through the WTO. And did I guess what that mechanism is supposed to do in the sense that it, the court ruled that something was illegal, and then the U.S. sort of backed out of that illegal activity. And so, you know, throughout that, I guess you have this welfare analysis. I'm just wondering what the who are the winners in every trade environment? We have winners and losers, right? So in this instance, where we have mandatory country of origin labeling repealed, who do you see as kind of the winners and the losers in this scenario?
Well, Eric, I think that when you think about the welfare implications, for example, of repealing the legislation, I think that, you know, there are a lot of benefits to think about across the board, because when you repeal the legislation, you're essentially making it cheaper on the whole, or relatively less expensive on the whole, to produce beef. And while we said those supply chain costs are relatively small, we're talking 1% at the farm gate, 2% at processing and retail levels. So 2%, while small, still does have an impact. So I think that the benefits to be gained are, you know, you can have increased efficiency in the beef supply chain, because you no longer have to worry about this commingling issue. And, you know, there's benefits to having these cost reductions. I think that what is interesting from the study that I've worked on is that the impacts of COOL really aren't as big for Canada and Mexico as what we would have thought in terms of the modeling results that we have seen. And I think one of the challenges and something that we really strive towards as economists is try to do our best job of representing what's really happening in an economic framework. And what's interesting is that when you have a longer run model, number one, you have a variety of assumptions that you're making about the economic environment, for example. And so in our modeling results, we're seeing that there's huge benefits, I should say relatively big benefits, for the U.S. livestock and beef supply chain. And the impacts on Canada and Mexico are relatively muted. So the majority of the benefits you do end up seeing in the United States for domestic producers. So another potential benefit that perhaps doesn't get enough attention is that we talked a little bit ago about some producers feel very strongly about a potential premium to be gained by labeling their beef. And if everyone has to do it, it's more challenging for you to differentiate your domestically sourced, domestically produced and raised beef. And by repealing the legislation, I think that opens the door for greater product differentiation in the beef supply chain or in the beef retail case. So for Montana producers, for example, who do have, whether it's just Montana raised or if it's just US raised beef that was produced by livestock raised in the US as well, I think that you still have the opportunity to capture rents if they do exist in the market. And it's easier for you to differentiate your product because not everyone now has to label.
What do you mean by rents?
Rents. So a price premium, for example. So if you go to the retail meat counter, if you go to the grocery store, there are producers who believe that if they have a ribeye that says that it was produced by livestock that were born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States or in Montana, that a consumer might be willing to pay more for that particular ribeye than another ribeye sitting right next to it, even if it's of equal quality that isn't labeled where that livestock was born, raised, and slaughtered, for example. So what I mean by rent is price differences between products based on different reasons. So things that differentiate one steak from another.
Yeah. And I guess this whole discussion brings up sort of a bigger topic. And Anton, you probably talk about the wheat market a little bit here, but the whole idea of in an increasingly global agricultural production system, we're sending more and more product overseas. How important is the country of origin labeling when we deliver products overseas, whether we're talking about wheat or with beef products?
I think with wheat, that is something that the U.S. wheat industry as a whole has really tried to promote, that U.S. wheat is better. It's consistent quality. Regardless of what year you get it, you can mill it into the same flour that can make the same consistent product. And that's really what millers want. They want consistency. And that's, I think, where the product differentiation for the United States comes from, that, you know, if you try to buy from Australia or from Russia, there's just both the production infrastructure and the supply chain infrastructure, like the storage, the transportation, it's not as good as we have it in the United States. And so from that end, that is, I think, a big talking point for the U.S. wheat industry is consistency and high quality on a consistent level. And I don't know, is that what the U.S. livestock industry tends to focus on?
I mean, I think you do see, especially in the Asia Pacific region, the U.S. beef product has been marketed quite a bit in Japan, especially. You know, there have been a lot of years where that has been developed. And so I think that carries with it a bit of a premium, whether you're talking about in Japan. You know, I think China is one market where, given that we opened up beef trade with them a bit more last year, you know, optimistic if things sort of settle down between the two countries that we could really start to realize those same benefits in a country like China, where we do have a big consumer base to sell into with the incomes growing fairly quickly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with beef, I took a class, Follow the Grain class, which is a really cool hands-on experiential program that we run here in the department. Eric, you're taking a class to China this year, right?
We're going to China to learn about Chinese consumers,
right,
and Alibaba and JD.com.
Yeah, so really important stuff. Last year, I took a class to the United Kingdom to think about all the Brexit issues and policy implications for the ag sector. But 2 years before that, we went to France and Italy. And while we were in Milan, in the middle of Milan in Italy, there was a Montana steakhouse. No joke, it was labeled Montana Steakhouse, and they served beef from the United States. So I think, unlike wheat, for example, there is some cachet of having the steak that comes all the way from the United States that is going to be, you know, you're going to have this. You go into the restaurant, you put on a cowboy hat, and all of a sudden you are transformed into the Western United States region as you're eating this steak. So there seems to be some benefit that the that the U.S. livestock industry does enjoy in other parts of the world, and certainly to some extent, I would think in the United States that our beef is good.
Yeah, well, and I think, and you're bringing up a great point, Anton. We talked a bit about sort of voluntary labeling versus mandatory labeling, and that certainly shows the option of, you know, if you're going to put your label on there and you really know you have a premium for it, sending your product overseas with that label is going to carry with it that expected premium. So we can see that in the prices that are recovered.
Well, I think this also highlights what you were talking about in terms of quality and differences in production practices. And I think the beef industry is a really great example globally about different supply chains, different production practices that produce a very different final product. So in Japan, for example, there is a strong preference for U.S. beef because it's grain finished. We've got high marbling, a very different taste, texture, and quality when you compare it to some of our competitors in the global market who have more grass-fed production. At the same time, we could look in the United States where we have a premium for grass-fed beef that's different from our mainstream conventional beef production. So what I think is so great about voluntary options for labeling things and this potential for the emergence of product differentiation, as a producer, you really have the ability to showcase what you produce. And so, for example, in the United States, we do have important brand recognition around the world for very high quality grain-fed, grain-finished beef product or beef products at the meat counter, for example. And I think what's challenging if we bring this back to country of origin labeling is that I think it's a rather complicated question to think about the implications of mandatory country of origin labeling, because again, I think some of the perceived benefits or potential benefits from country of origin labeling, especially for the final produced good, which is the steak that you're buying at the grocery store, consuming at the restaurant, I think that when we think about the U.S. supply chain, when we import livestock from Canada or Mexico to feed them out in the United States, you're going to end up with a similar product that is difficult, if not impossible, to differentiate at the final product stage. So that steak that you finally are sitting down to enjoy at your dinner table or at the restaurant, it's going to be challenging to know whether or not that calf was born in Canada or the United States if it was finished in the U.S. in our supply chain. So I think that's one of the big challenges with mandatory country of origin labeling is that it is difficult to differentiate that final product because you're talking about something that's at the very start of the supply chain that could end up being finished in the same manner with which we finish our domestically raised calves.
Okay, so here's a question that I hear sometimes. Eric, you probably hear a lot. If we don't have country of origin labeling, mandatory country of origin labeling, and we can, anyone, say Brazil or Mexico, can just send their beef over to the United States and packing plants can get their beef from anywhere they want and they don't have to label, what's stopping Brazil from just undercutting U.S. prices and then that working down the supply chain to the producers of U.S. cattle and basically lowering the price, right? This is an argument that I hear a lot, right? These other countries are dumping their beef on the U.S. market. That's bringing down prices. What's going on there? Is that a legitimate question?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess there are, you know, grading systems that are set up to kind of maintain quality and grade that quality so that when you buy beef, you know what you are buying. And, you know, as we were talking about before, I think it is important to note that we have a lot of brands, and Amanda, you're visiting Montana here. You probably saw a lot of the Montana brands here in the supermarket. And those brands they're using those brands as a way to receive a premium for the production practice that they're employing. And so I think that maintains prices so that, you know, countries like Brazil aren't able to just come in and just dump a product on us. Although, as we learned in our last podcast, dumping is illegal in the WTO. Amanda told us that. So.
Well, the other thing, not only is dumping illegal in the WTO, we have measures in place in the United States that if we find evidence of another country illegally dumping product into the United States, we have policy measures already in place that we can employ. So a perfect example of that would be anti-dumping and countervailing duties, which is a very fancy way of saying an import tariff. And the reason for having that import tariff is because of the presence of dumping. So for example, if let's say that I won't name a country. Let's say another country were to start exporting beef to the United States at a highly discounted price. That is an unfair price that had to have had some sort of domestic subsidy in order to attain this price level or to make it possible. If the U.S. were to impose anti-dumping and countervailing duties, that could be challenged in the World Trade Organization. And if the other country was found to, in fact, be dumping their product, the U.S. would be upheld in their action of imposing these potential policies. So I think the question of, you know, unfair competition in the marketplace by allowing for imports, that's a very different question and a very different policy measure that would be appropriate than considering this idea of country of origin labeling. So right. There are other policy measures that we could directly deal with or directly combat any potential dumping that should be separate from country of origin labeling. In fact, I would argue that country of origin labeling likely would not be the most effective or appropriate measure to even try to combat dumping, because we haven't seen evidence of huge differences in consumer willingness to pay differentiated prices from beef sourced from other countries.
Yeah, and we do have effective quotas on most of our countries that we import beef from. So Brazil, Australia, New Zealand, we don't have them with Canada, Mexico, because we're part of the new NAFTA. But with the other countries, we do have quotas to kind of prevent them from bringing in too much beef.
Yeah, and not yet, not new NAFTA yet, right? The three legislatures have to approve
that's
that
right.
Before we get there. So the U.S. produces really good beef, right? Especially like the steak cuts. Are we getting the same quality beef from other countries? Perhaps I'll do the same as you, Amanda, not name countries. But are we getting the same type of beef? Like, is it direct competition of beef that's coming in? Or is there worrying that they're coming with the same product but maybe at a lower price because maybe their labor costs are lower or something else? Like, what are the products the same? Are we weighing T-bones versus T-bones instead of T-bones versus apples? I don't know. Try to make a livestock example.
Yeah, I mean, our sort of comparative advantage is in the high-quality cuts of beef. I mean, we can look at that in our export markets. As far as imports go, you know, what we import a lot of is hamburger to try to get enough of that. So we, you know, it is somewhat strange to think about an industry where you import about 10% of your production and you also export 10% of your production. Why you would do both of those, you know, when we teach this in our introductory econ classes, we have, well, you're either a net exporter or a net importer. And certainly within beef, you know, we have areas where we're a net importer and then other areas where we're a net exporter.
Well, I think, Eric, you're pointing to a perfect example of why trade is so important and some of the benefits of trade, in that having trade with other countries or freer trade allows for a greater number of choices, a different mix of product varieties and qualities that we are able to choose from. So, for example, you know, we could think of another country that has grass-fed production competing with U.S. grass-fed production, for example. But that allows the consumer to decide in the marketplace what they want to purchase. So, again, I think it's important for consumers to be able to have greater choices for different product varieties and quality in the marketplace.
And certainly we would think that greater choice is a good thing for consumers, right? More variety, potentially there's more competition. So we would think that it's utility satisfaction increasing if we have more choices out there for consumers. Let's wrap up with this. This has been a really informative discussion, at least for me. What else are you working on? What do you got in the pipeline? Give us a few things to ponder and have you back in a year to talk about all your cool research that you're doing.
I'm doing lots of cool research. So in line with the country of origin labeling questions that I've been looking at, we also have something similar in the wool supply chain or in the textiles and fabric supply chain. So part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership allowed for provisions regarding what are called rules of origin. Rules of origin are basically the same thing as country of origin labeling, but with a different supply chain. So thinking about where does Where does fabric originate? Where does the primary commodity used to create a fabric originate? So that has impacts for cotton, has impacts for wool. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership has some pretty strong language about rules of origin and requiring products that are made from fibers to be sourced from Trans-Pacific Partnership member countries. That has important implications for the cotton industry and the wool industry. So I'm working on some stuff about rules of origin. And from a more general or broader perspective, working on a lot of interesting questions related to potential bilateral or multilateral trade agreements. So, well, you know, what are the impacts of some of these trade policies, whether it's a tariff measure or a non-tariff measure? There's a lot of really interesting questions, a lot of cool questions to ask about trade. Some things that are a little bit different that I'm working on is looking at what some of the This is a bit different from my typical AgEcon portfolio, but important for agriculture is thinking about the potential implications of trade on non-indigenous species spread. So as I'm a trade policy and an ag trade economist, and thinking about, you know, an important vector for introduction of new species to an environment is trade. We have critters. We have bugs that attach to ships. We have insects that can jump onto shipping crates. And when we transport goods from one country to another, there are important health and safety implications of introducing new things to the environment. So that's another area that I'm working on, is looking at what are some of the trade implications for the spread of non-indigenous species that can have important implications for agricultural production. So that's kind of the broad areas that I'm working on that are pretty fun and I think really important and relevant for U.S. agriculture.
Yeah, and certainly really important for Montana agriculture, being part of the West where you're at right now. So I think, just like Eric and myself, we constantly think about, well, how does our work relate back to Montana agriculture? And, you know, Montana is not that different from Colorado. You know, we have just a fewer people, but you know, other than that, we're basically the same. Someone is going to send a very angry email my way for saying that. Okay, all right.
All of our Colorado listeners.
Yes. I deserve it. And you know what you deserve is more blog posts and more podcasts, and you can always get that information on the AgEconMT.com website. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, where you will get the brand new episode every time that we post it. And check us out. Send us an email. Send us a question. Subscribe to our newsletter. We are as accessible as we can be, and we want to be there to answer your questions and listen to your thoughts. What's happening locally? What's happening to your business? How are these different policies impacting your business? Where are you headed? What's your optimism level? All of those things, all of those great things that we as economists think about. So with that, Amanda, thanks so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Eric, as always, fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, safe travels back. And check her research out. And as I said, we'll have her back for sure to follow up on some of the really neat stuff that she's working on. So with that, I'm Anton Beckerman. And until next time, may the weather be always in your favor.